evening. My name is Mark, and I am an alcoholic. It is now time for the newcomer ask portion of the program. You may have seen this box in the back of the room. It says on it, a newcomer ask. What we'd like you to do, if newcomers to the program have questions about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, write it down on a 3x5 card, stick it in this slot. We'll pull a question out at random and attempt to answer that question using AA-approved literature and our panel of experts. Question submitted from last week is, why does Mark sound like a used car salesman? There's no name on the bottom. It's signed anonymous. So thank you, Lige. Used car salesman. Well, there's nothing for sale here. But there is something that's absolutely free, and it's also fun, and that's the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, if you work those steps exactly and precisely as they're outlined in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, you too can be free from alcohol for your entire life one day at a time. And for absolutely free, if you act now, we'll throw in the 12 traditions. If you're not completely satisfied with this program, your misery will be refunded. Used car salesman. Okay, if you remember from last week, we had a question submitted, and it said, they are telling me no relationships for at least a year. How long is a year? Last week, Bill H. handled the male side of that question, and this week, the woman's side of the question is going to be answered by our own Catherine.
Hi, I'm Catherine, and I'm an alcoholic. And forgive me for not standing, but I can't read out of a book and stand on a walker at the same time, so hopefully you'll just be able to hear what I have to say, maybe. Okay, well, first, the part two of that question, how long is a year? A year is 365 days, okay? And the thing about that is that my experience, and all of this is based, I'm going to do a little reading here in a second, but my experience is what I'm going to share and my opinion. And again, what I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous is that we all have opinions. And it's okay if you have your opinion, and it's okay if I have my opinion. And my experience is my story and my path. And part of why I answered the second part of 365 days is because I am very alcoholic. My experience was that I did not wait to get into a relationship. I got sober in April, and I met my first husband in Alcoholics Anonymous, my only husband in Alcoholics Anonymous, in April, same year. And my alcoholic brain led to tell me that we were just friends. And my motives hidden down inside, deep inside of myself, that I didn't want to share with anybody knew different. I knew I was going to marry him. And I waited just long enough to say, oh, yeah, we were friends. And then we started dating. And then we got engaged. And a year and 1 month after I met this man, we were married, which qualified me for having waited a year. Now, that was my concept of waiting a year to get into a relationship. And as being a new alcoholic, or recognizing and accepting that I was an alcoholic, and being new at this, my brain was still justifying, my motives were not being looked at, and I was still doing what I wanted to do. That's been my experience, and that has been part of my path, and I got to learn a lot from that. Now, on the second part to that question, or the second half to that thought in my mind, is my suggestion to women, because I am giving a woman's point of view, is to wait until you do have a year. And I'm going to read out of another book. We have the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, which Bill W. and Bob wrote in the very beginning, Dr. Bob. And later on, they wrote another book called, Bill W. wrote another book called The 12 Steps and the 12 Traditions. And in there is, in the 12th step, a specific section that talks about boy meets girl on AA campus. And this is going to explain why I agree with the waiting process. Now, I don't know who came up with the idea of a whole year, but in reading this, it makes sense to me. And in my experience, although I'm not regretting my past or my path that God had me on, although I'm not sure I was in God's will at the time I made those decisions, I would suggest to any woman not only to listen to these words in the book, but to read them and to pray about it on your own. And to allow, what I did not do is allow myself to get to know myself. I did not allow myself time to become a formal, sober woman in Alcoholics Anonymous, able to take care of herself, and I came in here with no self-respect. And I certainly can't get into a relationship expecting any kind of respect, because I didn't even respect myself. And it wasn't until I was able to sit down and fully do the 12 steps of the program and have enough experience in Alcoholics Anonymous that I was able to learn how to even obtain self-respect for me. Then I could start asking that men respect me as well. And so what I'm going to read to you is on page, and if you want to look it up when you get home or if you have your book with you, you can follow along. It's in the 12 and 12, the 12th step on page 119. And it says, AA has many single alcoholics who wish to marry and are in a position to do so. Some marry fellow AAs. How do they come out? On the whole, these marriages are very good ones. That's probably about as far as I read when I first decided to get married, because that was what I wanted to hear. Their common suffering as drinkers, their common interest in AA and spiritual things, often enhance such reunions. It is only where boy meets girl on AA campus and love follows at first sight that difficulties may develop. The prospective partners need to be solid AAs and long enough acquainted to know that their compatibility at spiritual, mental, and emotional levels is a fact and not wishful thinking. They need to be sure as possible that no deep-lying emotional handicap in either will be likely to rise up later under later pressure to cripple them. The considerations are equally true and important for the AAs who marry outside AA with clear understanding and right grown-up attitudes. Very happy results do follow. And what can be said of many AA members who, for a variety of reasons, cannot have a family life? At first, many of these feel lonely, hurt, and left out as they witness so many domestic happiness about them. If they cannot have this kind of happiness, can AA offer them satisfactions of similar worth and durability? Yes. Whenever they try hard to seek them out, surrounded by so many AA friends, these so-called learners tell us they no longer feel alone. In partnership with others, women and men, they can devote themselves to many number of ideas, people, and constructive projects. Free of marital responsibilities, they can participate in enterprises which would be denied to family men and women. We daily see such members render prodigies of service and receive great joy in return. So for me, that is where I come up, and I agree with the philosophy of waiting for a year. Now, does it have to be a year? I don't know. But if you are getting grown up and you're working the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, to me, that seems to be about a year. So that's just my opinion, and that's my experience, and I thank you for letting me share that with you tonight.
Thank you, Catherine. And now it is time for our featured speaker of the evening. This is brought to you by the Valley Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, the undefeated, undisputed king of speaker meetings. This event is brought to you for your sobriety pleasure. And now, let's get ready for recovery. Our speaker has been a sober member since 1982. He has been a part of groups in Fresno, San Jose, Los Angeles, Angels Camp, and Visalia. In service, he has been an H&I representative, a CSR, a GSR, and is a founder of several young people's groups, in addition to holding all group-level positions. And now, with all the earnestness at your command, will you welcome, please, from Fresno, California, Mickey B.
Good evening, family. My name is Mickey, and I am an alcoholic. Is it time to rumble? I'd like to start out with a tradition that I learned from one of my home groups years ago. And that is, if there's someone here who would like to have a big book that doesn't have one, I'd like to buy you one tonight. So if there's anyone here that wants a big book, please raise your hand. Okay. Who has the least amount of sobriety, the least amount of time? Okay, would you like to come up and get your big book, young lady? I'd also like to take this opportunity to express my deepest gratitude for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, without which I could very easily be in a hospital, a jail, a prison, or possibly even dead by my own hand due to my alcoholism, my untreated alcoholism. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous in good standing since March 25th, 1982. And my primary purpose tonight is to make this program as attractive to you as the old-timers made it to me when I got here in 1982. This is a wonderful program, and this is a wonderful place to get sober. Visalia is a great place. I'm calling this my return to the scene of the crime. I drank here. I actually didn't start drinking here, but I did drink here, and so this was the second level, and I guess this is where my drinking career started. I went on to drink more in other various places, but the main thing I want to tell you is that the reason my life changed, my life got better, was work because I worked with a sponsor, worked the steps, and found a power greater than myself. And I continue doing what I've done in the first year of sobriety. I say that the first year was the best year, but it was also the worst year. And by that, I mean I went through a lot of stuff. My first year of sobriety, when I got my chip, my cake, I shared something like, if I knew it was going to be like this, I would have never got sober. But the good news is that every time something came up that I had to deal with, there was always, and I still remain, there was always somebody there to help me. My sponsors, other people. I never know who's going to carry my message. I don't know if it's a newcomer or somebody who's been here a long time, or possibly somebody who's just coming back from going out on a binge and relapsing. You know, I owe so much to Alcoholics Anonymous. I am a product of hospitals, jails, and institutions. I've been to prison. I've tried working with professionals, and they gave up on me. I didn't get sober till I got here, and I'm very grateful that I didn't get to Alcoholics Anonymous till I was done. If I'd got here any sooner, I might have played around. I might not have hit my bottom. I might have continued to be in that tornado while I was drinking sober. So I'm real grateful for that. I have two children with my marriage, and I put them through hell. I put my wife through hell, my bosses, everyone else, and they just tolerate me. And no one ever told me, you know, because I was such this macho guy, no one ever told me, you need help or you do this. They just kind of got out of the way. And that's what I meant by professionals. Professionals, even they gave up on me. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous for real long here. I was a biker, and I parked my bike where I wasn't supposed to. The oil dripped and all this, and I didn't give a, you know, what. And I came in using four-letter words. I'm not talking about hope or love. That's the best I could do when I got here. See, I don't know why any of you are here. It's none of my business. I only know why I'm here. I'm an alcoholic. And under the influence of alcohol, I take chemicals. And I hang out with criminals. That's just my story. I'm a low bottom, so if you're new, I want you to just listen for the similarities. I went very far, very low before I hit my bottom. That was just the way it was. And when I first got to Alcoholics Anonymous, there were more people like me of that type when I got here. So it's those that saw through all my BS and my facade and all that and loved me until I could love myself. I honestly would come in and talk these four-letter words and be very vulgar about my speech and language and everything. People would come in, and then once they would see me, someone would walk back out. And at first I thought they were just going to the bathroom, but they wouldn't come back. And one night I heard myself. I heard what I was saying, and what at the time I believe was one of the most spiritual meetings. There were a couple of fathers there and people that were very spiritual in my eyes. And I heard what I was saying, what the words were coming out of my mouth. And my spirit was convicted. And I couldn't wait to leave. I think I even stopped in the middle of what I was sharing, because they really hit me for the first time. My soul was convicted, and I left, and I was never going to come back to that meeting. So about 6 months later or so, I'm downtown meeting somebody, and I'm down at one of the big hotels. And as I walk in, this lady from that particular group recognized me and called my name. And I tried to duck out and leave, but I kind of got stuck in the door. And by then, she started saying my name louder and louder, and everybody was starting to watch. And I knew that she was going to tell me off. So I just kind of waited, and it was kind of like one of those slow-motion movies, you know, scenes where you cut to her, and she gets bigger, and you cut to me, and I get smaller, you know. And just as she's right in front of me, I did act like a spot check, 10-step inventory. And I said, okay, whatever she says, you got coming. So just stand here and take it, you know. You've been a no good, this and that and that. And so whatever she's got to tell you, you take it. So I'm there, I'm braced for the worst. And what does she do? She reaches her arms out and hugs me. He said, how have you been? We miss you. And with that took all that anger and rage out of me. She just loved me unconditionally at that point, which is what I could not admit to you when I got here. That's what I've been looking for all my life. My dad left when I was about a year old. I grew up without brothers. I grew up on the streets. I grew up fighting and this and that. And no, I'm not saying no one ever tried to love me. I just never let them love me, you know, if they ever wanted to get close to me. And if I was going through something, I was going through some kind of pain, I had to hurt you. You know, if I want to make you feel the way I felt. And so I had this chip on my shoulder. And these people at Alcoholics Anonymous loved me till I could love myself. And that's one of the reasons, that was like a big turning point for me about being a part of. And then I had a very good sponsor, and he used to just take me to different AA service commitments that he was involved with, and I just followed. And one of the first jobs I had in AA was washing out ashtrays. This goes back a long, long time ago. And I like that because even though I was a tough guy, I was scared. Deep down, I was kind of scared of you, scared of people. So that helped me. If I was washing those ashtrays, I wouldn't have to talk to no one. And I'm talking about 100, 200 ashtrays. It was a big, big meeting, speaker meeting where circus speakers came in. And I actually got to hear Chuck Chamberlain speak at that meeting when I was early in my sobriety. And so by washing those ashtrays, I kind of got to stay out of the way. And I didn't have to mingle. Afterwards, everybody would mingle and talk to each other. I couldn't talk to anyone. So I stayed hidden watching those ashtrays. And little by little, people would come up and say hi to me. And that's how I got to know people, kind of through the back door that way. And then before long, I could go almost anywhere in town and someone would recognize me. And that was a good feeling to be a part of, you know, be a part of. Because when I got here, man, I was just so mean and angry, and I was suicidal, and just like, this was the last house on the block, and for me it really was. I had alienated family and business and all this kind of stuff. I'd been fired or I left before I got fired, and it wasn't until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous that I found someone that cared, someone that really cared. No one has ever asked me, what do you do? How much money do you make? How many credentials? Or this or that? No one has ever asked me that. All they ask is, do you want a second chance at life? If you do, if you want to do what we did, you go to any length, we'll go to hell with you. But if you don't, you can go to hell by yourself. They also said, you're only going to get out what you put in. And you didn't get sick overnight, don't expect to get well overnight. You know, and a lot of these little cliches, little one-liners, that's what kept me going for a long time. And then until I got into working the steps with the sponsor. And step one was not a problem whatsoever. Again, I've been a product of hospitals, jails, and institutions. And I knew that in the last of my drinking, I had some guys I ran with, and I used to tell them, if we're going to go out, give me a call before 10 p.m., because after 10, I'm going to lock myself down and get wasted, you know. If you call me before, I can halfway maintain. But I knew that it was just a matter of time when I drank, wherever I drank, that I'd go to jail. That was just a given. In fact, last time I went to jail, they gave me, you know, that ticket, that phone call, and I refused it because I knew it was just a matter of time, maybe a week, maybe a month, I was coming back. There's no place for me else to go after that. It's like, I know, I've seen this movie too many times. This movie always winds up on a dead-end street, and I'm in the gutter, you know. And so I refused to take that phone call. I said, I'm not going anywhere. So I said, okay. And then about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, I hear my name and saying, roll them up. And I'm pissed off because there's no place for me to go, you know. And someone, people, this is the way God, you know, the higher power has worked for me in my life. I'm a loner. I go party and this and that. Parts unknown. I just head out and I'll wind up someplace and I'll party and I'll be passed out. I'll wake on the side of the street or a lamppost or somebody's backyard, on the couch, whatever. That's just the way my rambling, rebellious drinking nature was. And so when I started looking at in my inventory and stuff, step one was no problem. I knew that one, and I dug into it further and further. And the more I dug, the more I saw how deep my alcoholism really went. See, I almost killed a police officer under the influence. Never had any guilt or remorse whatsoever about it. It was in a blackout. And all I know is what was in the reports and all that kind of stuff. That's for me, that's the top one, the very top of my first step. A powerless over alcohol, my life's unmanageable. That's totally, all that's unmanageable under the influence. The other thing is I try to kill myself. I loaded a gun with 158 grain hollow points. And that leaves a mess. So if I had the gun to my head, I put my favorite song on, because that's what alcoholics do. You put your favorite song on, and then you say, she'll be sorry. I'm going to kill myself, and she's going to be sorry. And so I really don't know. I've never been able to really know what really happened. But I believe in my mind, I believe that my daughter, the doorbell rang or someone knocked on the door, and my thought that possibly it was my youngest daughter coming home from school early. And that just broke my train of thought right there, just boom. And that's the only reason I'm here today. And it's been like that for, you know, over 30 years. God has done for me what I couldn't do for myself, even though I was rebelling and saying, you know, go to hell or whatever, you know. That's the person I am. Deep down inside, without the steps, without sponsorship, without fellowship, without a higher power, I'm liable to go back to doing that kind of stuff. I would be the guy that, if you were my neighbor, they'd come in, the media would come out and interview you and say, oh, he was a nice guy and this and that, you know, I can't believe he killed all those people. See, I'm a low bottom alcoholic, but I'm also a high bottom serial killer. And I stopped just in time because my anger and rage was just tremendous. So step one was not a problem. Step two, again, wasn't either because I knew about my insanity. In fact, I told my sponsor, I'm not an alcoholic. When you talk about grave emotional mental disorder, you know, I'd raise my hand every time I heard that when I was new, you know, when I read chapter 5. I said, I'm nuts, but I'm not an alcoholic. He said, well, how about this? How about if you put the drugs and alcohol down, put them down, and see what happens? Well, what happened is I stopped going to jail right off the bat. Boom. You know, so that was working. But the one I didn't have a problem with was the third step. I would take an ass whooping, I'd take a beating, anything, you know, but to go meet God on God's terms, you know, I'd do anything. I looked for the loopholes and try to do this and that, and so it wasn't getting any better. Finally, I started talking to a bunch of old timers, And I'm very, very grateful that I had a lot of old-timers and people that are willing to spend hours with me, you know, at the coffee shops or wherever, hours. And so I went out asking a bunch of them from different walks of life, men and women, what that third step was about. Basically, what I got from them all, basically the same answer was, well, when we did a thorough third step, we wound up doing what we always felt like we wanted to, but never felt we had the education, the skills, the training, the self-esteem to do that. So with that, I did a third step, you know, and I said, God be gentle, this is my first time. Take it easy. And so my fear was that once, you know, God got me in that place, you know, that place where I would have surrender, that he would take advantage of me. And so what happened, I'd wind up on the 10-speed in a blue suit selling Bibles the rest of my life. And that's really what I felt. Well, I'm sober almost 30 years, and I haven't had to do that. And some of my friends say, yes. So that is how I finally got into doing the third step. Blind faith based on your experience, strength, and hope that I really believed, and I wanted something better than drinking. So I surrendered to win, is what they used to say. And the fourth and fifth step weren't foreign to me because I had gone to a Catholic, had some Catholic upbringing, so I understood the confessional kind of part of that. But the thing that I was the most, I guess, revealing and glaring thing for me to stay with was my part of it. I always knew your part of it, and I was easy quick to blame, but I had never really looked at my part of anything. And that one is the one aspect of that fourth step that has really changed my life, because even now, over the years, I've had to go back and do that in different things. And when I am willing to look at my part of something, I can always find it. I may not like it, and they say, you know, the truth will set you free. Well, it will, but in the beginning, it's going to make me very uncomfortable, because I don't want to look at myself. You know, I don't want to see the ugly person that's been hiding in there all those years based on childhood this and childhood that. I am a product of a dysfunctional family. And all of that went on there was not normal. And because of that, it helped enforce some of the chips on my shoulder and all that kind of stuff, which, again, I used to blame God for all of that stuff. I'm glad to be in my cell. Yeah, I've got my mom is buried here. She died of cancer. I've got a brother who's also buried here, and he died of the disease. And I've got a sister. So I've got deep roots in my cell. Yeah. In fact, I used to walk around, you know, some of these areas. My first job was over here at Bailey's. If you guys remember Bailey's, they used to manufacture pants for JCPenney's, and we used to work there. The old depot. I used to walk the grounds of the old depot when it was in ruins, just in ruins. And I remember saying one time, this would make a nice place, but it was in ruins, and years later they did that. I mean, I've got footprints and wreckage all up and down, all through the valley, but, you know, more so down here, down the street here on Race and Cork, where the car washes, that they used to be an old Furla. They used to call it a Furla, which used to be a hamburger joint. Mostly the Chicanos and the Raza and there, they used to hang out there. And then we used to have a feud between the Furla and up on Mooney, Foster Freeze. The whites would hang out over here, and we'd hang over here in the barrio. And so it wouldn't matter. I mean, they'd come over and pick a fight with us, or we'd go there when we were bored on Friday night. And I used to go down there and eat Frito boats. That was the big deal. Frito boats and have a beer on the side, and no one was really watching, or at least I thought so. But right there at Fort Whip was the first time I got busted for drinking under the influence. A minor in possession way back then. So at about 13, 14 years old, I could have used this program. I mean, the signs were already there. I was just I mean, I was just waiting to act out all the stuff behind the alcoholism. And so you would think that would get my attention. But I, like I said, I went on for another 20 years drinking and drugging. And eventually, you know, I hit that bottom that has allowed me to stay here ever since. So the fourth and fifth, like I say, it was just a matter of looking at myself, which I had never done before to that level. And so the first one just brought out the surface stuff. And I've had to go back and do others because I've been more honest with myself and more has been revealed. And the last one I did was also about 22 years sober. And it's like with everyone, it's like I get a cleansing at a different level. And it allows me to accept more good things also, you know, and be able to give more of what I give. And anything I ever give to anyone, I'm actually giving it to myself, you know. It's like you got to give it away to keep it, and that's the exciting part is the more I give, the more I give. And the thing about being unconditional, if I give something, time, money, effort, energy to anyone, I don't expect to get it back from that person, but it's also, you know, like a spiritual law that'll come back to me and by some other means or some other people or some other way it'll come back. I give my higher power. So part of being in service is getting insurance against that first thing, like I was shared, working with others. I've got guys that I sponsored there a couple of months all the way to over 25 years. A couple of them are in the room tonight. And that's what I've learned here. Everything I know about life, I learned in my first year of sobriety. You know, and I've just been adding more tools over the years to that. The sixth and seventh step, I was afraid that once I did that, I did it at a church, and when I walked out, I was waiting for the bolt of lightning to hit it. And I thought I was going to be struck, you know, as white as driven snow. Well, that didn't happen. And I work on that. I still work on that. And I will continue working at it. But I can tell you that my family appreciates what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me in my life, because they are the ones that can best see that. I'm going to meet with them after this. We're going to go get something to eat and go hang out and share, you know, what's going on in their life. I'm grateful. My children's mom is what we call a normie. And so far, my children and my grandchildren have not shown any signs of disease. I've never had to worry about getting a phone call in the middle of the night, going to the jail, going to the hospitals, and so by their age, I was already so much into it and running so hard that that's something I'm really grateful for. And they've been, you know, to other meetings, they've heard me, they've heard my story, and they've heard me, and I've made my amends to them. And so that has been great as far as the eighth, ninth step. The tenth step, it's something that I do daily, and I used to tell, the old family used to say, work the steps, and at some point the steps will work you. And so what that means is, like, if I got in there and applied the steps to my life as best I could at whatever time, they'd eventually get the knowledge and all that and would go into my consciousness deeper and deeper. So after a while, it's not there to become automatic. You just know that you're doing it, and you're doing something, you're writing on a piece of paper, and you don't even, after you've done it, oh, that's what that was about. And there's been times I needed to backtrack. I'm having a bad day. I can start my day anytime I want, and then I can backtrack sometimes and say, well, what was the thought of the feeling that got me to where and to the funk I am or whatever right now? And I can easily go find it. I can easily find it. And sometimes I get triggered. I get triggered by a song, something someone might say in a meeting, and it stays in my subconscious stuff. So I work it out and I find out what it is. And so the chief activator of my character defects is always self-centered fear. The fear of losing something I have or not getting something that I am demanding. That's one of the most misquoted sayings in AA. People say, fear of losing something I have or not getting something I want. There's a big difference between a want and a demand, and that's what the big book talks about. And so I've been very demanding all my life, and I still can be demanding in sobriety. So I have to check that. And I also have to watch out for big shotism, you know. Some of the things that I'm most grateful for in this program are things that are way above and beyond anything that I could have ever done before. I don't want to talk about them very much because that's between my higher power and I and my family. And I'm very blessed. I just retired this summer. I'm in a good place. I'm not rich, but I'm comfortable. You know, but I pay my dues. I worked construction. I worked different jobs. One area of my life, I worked construction, and I worked in conditions in the elements out there without any shade or any shielding or anything, at as high as 115 degrees in the summer and as cold as 20 below zero. And during that time, I was drinking, you know. And when we were 20 below zero up at the Helms Project, on that underground power plant, we used to drink 191 Everclear. But that was just antifreeze. When it's that cold, you gotta drink something. So the 11th step is, for me, is something that a friend of mine, turned me on to it. He demonstrated it physically. By that I mean he used to have this tradition. He's passed away now, but he used to have this tradition that around Thanksgiving he would get a turkey and get all. He was single and get all the trimming and stuff. And he would cook, and he'd been a cook and he'd traveled in Europe, and so he was good at doing that. And then he'd get the around seven shoe boxes, you know, and he'd make little dinners. And he put the dinners all in, and he invited me several times. And we would go out in Fresno under the bridge, way before Parvarello House. And, you know, the Fresno Mission was there, but the Parvarello House and some of the other places weren't there yet. And we'd go around, and it was his mission to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous in that manner. So he would go out, and I'd go with him, and he'd always say, I always ask permission. I was real sensitive and ask permission, real sensitivity about allowing us to be in their camp, and they would let us in. And then we would share that the reason our lives are so good today, the reason we're not homeless, and the reason we don't have sleep in places like this, is because of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's true. That's true for me today, as it was back then. And so that for me, that was like a living 11th step, you know, to being a channel for God's will. And I also know some of the people that eventually did start Parvarello House, and I can't get into that because that would be some anonymity. But there are great people that have gotten sober and they've passed it on. They've given in a large way, contributed back, given back to the community. And so the 12th step is something that I do pretty much daily. And by that I mean, if I go to a meeting and if I just smile at a newcomer, that is carrying the message. Making somebody feel comfortable. Offering them some coffee if they don't take it or whatever, you know. Just doing something that I would never have ever thought to do before. Getting out of myself. And it goes like from that all the way to whatever level of giving I want to go. And so if you're new, I'd like to say keep coming back. It gets worse. And when it gets worse, that's when we want you to call us. We've been there. We've done that. We're not going to judge you. We just want to help you. And I don't try to preach. I try to reach. Because this is an awesome program. For me, it is the greatest movement of the 20th century. Alcoholics Anonymous came and restored us and helped us recreate our lives. And for the exchange of the bottle, we were given the keys, and the keys to the kingdom. That's my experience, and that's what I believe. So if you knew, I love seeing new people. I was involved with young people's groups for years, and see someone come in, it's young, before, you know, the 10, 15 years that the disease takes away from us, to have a chance to come and participate and get sober and have children, and your children don't ever see you in the messed up state that some of us have been. What a blessing. I owe so much to alcohol, so much. I wish I had more time to get into more stuff, but that's what I aspire to do, is to make this program as attractive to new people as they made it for me, because I was unlovable, I was unreachable, and professionals had given up on me, and alcohol and saved my life. And if you do, you know, relapse is not part of the program. Relapse is not part of the program. It's part of the disease, but it's not part of the program. But if you are one of those that needs to go back out, we accept you in whatever condition you come back in, as long as you come back in. Alcoholics Anonymous is a come-as-you-are party. We'll take you however you can get here. And you are the one that makes the decision about changing what it is you want to change in your time, in your own way. So if you're one of those that... And in Hollywood, we just call them reruns. Reruns. So if you're someone that does relapse, we want you to keep coming back. Because AA is like Motel 6. We'll leave the light on for you. Thank you.